And we are live. This is Value After Hours. I am Tobias Carlyle, joined as always by my co-host Jake Taylor. Our special guest today is Tim Travis. How are you, Tim?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.
Welcome back, Tim. Good to see you.
Thank you.
Always characterize you as a value guy who's got sort of a specialization in sort of options and financials. Is that fair?
I think that's somewhat fair. Definitely a value guy. I think that we're a little different in that we use a lot of tactics. So we'll do covered calls, cash secured puts. We'll do that type of stuff with options for our clients to add a little income and reduce the risk a bit. So I think that that's kind of a unique niche. But yeah, financials are definitely a space where we're confident in insurance, banking. But we also do a lot in real estate and energy and stuff like that. So wherever there's value, and we're constantly working to increase, our circle of competence. That's a big focus.
As a options guy, what do you think the impact of the 0 day to expiry options has been? Have you noticed any change in the
Not a
prices you
ton,
get
to be
in the
honest with
casino?
you. Yeah, not a ton. I mean, volatility's been pretty low. The volatility index has been pretty low. Most of the ways that we use options are longer term, so like maybe like 6 to 9 months, 12 months even. An example would be like I like the real estate investment space right now. Real estate investment trust. I think there's some value there in some of the triple net names. And so, a lot of those are paying dividends of 5.5%, and they're growing their earnings even in kind of the difficult rate environment. And so you might layer on a call, 10, 15% above the market price and add another 4 or 5%, and you're getting kind of double digit yield plus retaining some upside. So things like that is how we do it. We don't do the 0 day ourselves. I think obviously that's kind of the Robin Hood type genre of investor, I'd say.
Yeah, so you're selling that call to add on a little bit of extra. So you're saying 10 or 15%. If you get a 10 or 15% rise in the price, you'd be happy with that. So
In this
sell a call.
environment, I'm sure we'll touch on that, but yeah, in this environment, if you can get a double digit yield with the dividend plus the call premium and then still have, 15% upside on the stock or even 12, that's pretty attractive in this environment, in my opinion.
So you feel like
So
it's pretty unlikely to, I mean, it's not going to be like three bagger or, I mean, in that situation, you're
on
taking out
those
some of that,
spaces,
right? You're
yeah. And
taking
I'll
the
tell
right
you.
tail out.
Right. And it does burn you from time to time. I mean, we were super bullish on Meta and Google and Amazon going into last year, after they had sold off so aggressively in 2022. And so we capped some of our upside on a few of those names. We still did really, really well, and they were big positions. But that's also the discipline, and it's helped us. Like, stocks that haven't done great over the last decade, kind of, doing some selling some puts here, selling some calls, even like a stock like Citigroup, which has been just a total dog and a pain to own. But if you're selling puts, at certain prices and then using covered calls and then collecting the yield, it's worked out a heck of a lot better than it would have had we not employed those strategies.
What do you think is driving the low volatility?
I mean, there's a lot of contentment out there. Going into 2023, I feel like so many people, there was such an impetus on, okay, look, you can get yield in CDs, or high yield savings deposit or treasury bills. And then it was kind of as the year progressed and you saw the AI stuff take off, people started kind of getting greedy again. And then even us lowly value guys, we benefited the last few months of the year. It was kind of a ho-hum year, and then the last few months, small cap and value ripped, bonds ripped. So I think going into this year, there's a lot of optimism, and so I think just that complacency, reduces volatility. Still a lot of money, out there. So that would be my kind of best guess. I would expect to see volatility perk up. It's an election year, massive geopolitical disruption. It seems to get worse every day. So I would expect we'll have a March type event like we had last year, for instance.
Any reason not to look at the news is a good reason not to look at the news. I just ignore it completely these days.
Totally.
Let me give a shout out to all of the the calls. We've got Senator Minga in the house, Miami, Pittsburgh, Miami again, Petah Tikva, Israel, Basingstoke, Tring, UK, Tino's in Townsville, what's up? Malaga, España, Cleveland, Vestavia, Alabama, Brandon, Mississippi, Toronto, Brisbaneland, good job. What's that, Newey? I don't know, Australia somewhere. Nanaimo, someone's gonna have to help me out with that one. Springfield, Alabama, Edmonton, Lima, Norwich, Tallahassee, Sugarland, Sacktown, Gothenburg, London,
This is just
St.
fun to
Louis, Cromwell.
see if Toby can pronounce different
That's right.
words.
Lincolnshire, Santa Monica, what's up? Good spread. Someone wants to hear you talk a little bit about City. What's going on with City?
They reported earnings on Friday, and it was just a kind of a basket case quarter in terms of lots of one-off charges. They had the FDIC surplus charge, so the big banks are having to pay for, the VC-backed banks that failed last year. That's one reason it's a frustrating industry to invest in. So they had a 1.7 billion, charge for that. Then they had a bunch of
Wow, that much,
Argentinian.
huh?
Yeah, that's what they had. It's due up based off size, really.
Right.
And then Argentina had some big charges with their devaluation. So outside of that, it wasn't a bad quarter with some of their. So it wasn't a good quarter though either. The new CEO, I mean, she's not new. She's been there a couple of years now, but she took on a tough job. They had a major restructuring. They've done a lot of the work. So this is the year where you should see an inflection and the cost curve start to go down. So it kind of reminds me of Wells Fargo a couple years back when Charlie Scharf took over and they had the regulatory issues, and then they went on some pretty aggressive cost cuts. I think Citi's in a similar space. Really, for me, it's not that I love the business. It's not a great business by any means, but I mean the stock's trading, around 52, 51 and some change, and you got a tangible book value at 86. They think they're going to earn, 11 to 12% on tangible capital in a few years, maybe. Can they earn 10% again? Yeah. And I think capital markets will be a lot better. There's a lot of pent-up demand. So we'll see. But yeah, I think it's attractive. I understand people not liking it.
What do net interest margins look like these days right now in the big banks?
For Citi's got international scope. So theirs is holding up a little bit better than some of the other ones. I think the expectation is that net interest margins and net interest income peaked in 2023. We'll see. I mean,
Yeah.
is the yield curve correct right now? I really think it could go either way. I mean, if you said, look, we have a supply issue in the Middle East that's increasing inflation and rates aren't going to go as fast aggressive as down as quickly, I would understand that. And if you said, look, the economy is kind of falling apart and rates are going to go down a lot more aggressively, that wouldn't shock me either. So I try to be somewhat agnostic there.
Neither one of those sound like that good of scenarios either.
That's my mentality right now. I'm not the
Yeah.
most optimistic I've ever been in the world.
How do you feel
Either
about?
inflation or depression, those are our two
Yeah.
paths.
Yeah. The
Let's hope we have the
in-between's
wisdom to
okay.
choose. What about financials? So banks in general, financials generally, same deal.
Well, I think like insurance companies have done really well. So like big positions for us for a long time, for many years, were like Assured Guaranty, Municipal Bond Insurance Company, AIG was a big one, Fairfax, Berkshire, some of those higher, and the mortgage insurers. I mean, all of those are have rocketed higher, and have performed really, really well. I mean, really, it's just kind of a, even though they're highly regulated, they're not in the spotlight as much as the bank. So I think that that's kind of an advantage. Nothing's really as bad as the banking industry, it seems, as far as just regulation and sentiment and volatility, economic stress. But yeah, so those have been good, but we're selling into this. I mean, we've seen a big rally on those names, so I think it's a good time to take some profits there.
What do
Isn't
you
it kind
make
of
of
hard to
the?
sell?
Isn't it tough to sell Fairfax still like at book value?
No, Fairfax is one I'm not selling. So
Okay.
I yeah, to be and I would put Berkshire in a similar class as that. But those are, I think, better business, especially Berkshire. And I like Fairfax a lot too there. I think they're capable of generating a better return on equity than some of the other ones. The mortgage insurance space, I mean, we bought those at big discounts to book. Now a lot of them are at premiums to book. And I don't know how I feel about housing. I have some concerns. I mean, they might be totally wrong, but I don't need to own those up here.
Yeah.
You guys don't have a divergent opinion on Fairfax, do you? You both pro
Same.
Fairfax.
I think we're both like it a lot and Prem Watsa.
Yeah, I mean, it's, well, obviously it was easier to buy it, whatever, 60 cents on the dollar book value. Like that felt like it made sense. But it, thankfully, it's never really run up past book to like really, force my hand and make me feel like I needed to sell. So I've been able to enjoy the rising interest income without Mr. Market testing me too much.
Do they still have all of the hedges and things in there that they sort of they made their made a pretty good name for themselves in 2008 with all the hedges, but is that are they still on? Are they
Didn't
not
work out
playing that game
so well
anymore?
for the 20, 2015 to 2019 period with the driving around with the brakes on. Didn't work out, but no, I don't believe that they have the, I think there's actually still some left over.
There's
Like they
still
have
some
some,
left, yeah.
like
Not as
they
much
have some
though.
swaps that are, I don't know, they're probably written down to practically nothing at this point, but I think they're still on the books.
Yeah, on the subject of Fairfax, there's one stock that they own quite a bit of. They're one of the largest shareholders, if not the largest, on Kennedy Wilson. It's that real estate company. They're based out of Los Angeles, and the equity I think is challenged, like a lot of the space. They have a little bit of office exposure in Europe, mostly, some in the U.S. They have an asset management business. They have a really good multifamily. They acquired a lot of this stuff via like distressed loans during the financial crisis, and then took on the loans when they defaulted, and then built stuff up. So they have some really they've done amazing stuff in Dublin, but right now their CapEx, they were in a big swing of spending a lot, and now that's going down. And the debt I think is an interesting play. So we've been able to buy those bonds at double digits. Even as high as I think 12% I believe was around kind of the high that we got in at, and I think now it's still probably around 9.5. And so it's interesting just because Fairfax has been a large sponsor. They even did a preferred stock issuance to Fairfax. So just on that topic, I think that's an interesting way to play.
How do you feel about the sort of ongoing debacle in office? Is that over? Best yet to
No, it's
come?
not over, man. It is not over. It's a nightmare. I mean, it's so bad. The occupancy levels are so weak in most areas. Now, Europe's kind of a different environment. They're not doing as much work from home as they are in the United States. But
Just not working at all, or I'm just kidding.
yeah, no, but I don't see that. I don't see that situation. Office is just tough, man. I wouldn't want anything that's individual office at the right price though. I mean, we actually did do some stuff with the Vornado and SLG when they got really, really depressed last year, but that was more of a trade than I'd say a long-term investment.
There's got to be some risk that a lot of those can't meet their debt obligations when they fall due. That's more of like a 2024, 2025 issue, isn't it, than a
Yeah, on the
2023 issue?
property level. Yeah, on the property level, exactly. A lot of them are gonna give back the keys, and so it just has to prices have to come down to where demand is. And I think big companies, they still want to be more office oriented, but it's a long haul. There's too much supply in a lot of the big cities like Los Angeles and San Fran. I mean, when those things are defaulting, it's huge. But to be clear, that's much more of an issue for some regional banks. And it's not, I don't even think it's going to be devastating for regional banks, but definitely the big banks and stuff like that, it's was totally overblown.
It's
Other,
overblown for the big banks.
oh yeah, for sure. On office, yeah, their exposure is not that huge at all. And they've reserved a lot. I think Wells Fargo, it was like at 11% reserve for office. So, I mean, if you think about what that entails, that's huge, I think commercial, how I got interested in real estate investment trust last year was that, I was looking at interesting areas in commercial real estate because a lot of that stuff came down 50%, 40%, 30%. And a lot of those, the triple net leases, a lot of those companies are doing really well, really high occupancy, some like 98, 99. I think apartments are pretty interesting. So there's various spaces there that I think are attractive. So I don't think you need to, speculate with office, especially a lot of that stuff had a huge run too, like Vornado and SLG. They ran up a lot from their lows.
And what do you see that sort of all looking like as we go through this 2024, go through an election cycle?
Oh gosh, I don't know. I mean, pick your poison. There's so many. I mean, especially with Davos going on now, it's always a weird agenda there, and then you have all the geopolitical issues. So I'm not optimistic on a lot of stuff. So that's why if I could get double digits this year, and even if the market was up 20%, if I was only up 12% or 14%, I'd be very happy with that. Especially if that's at the cost of if the market's down 15, being down 5 or flat, I'd be very happy with that type of outcome. So I don't think it's a year to be super aggressive, in my opinion. I might be totally wrong.
Toby, did you get your Davos invite, or did it get lost in the mail again?
I did, but the jet's in the garage, so
Okay.
I couldn't.
Yeah.
I'm not going to fly commercial. You don't fly commercial to Davos.
That
I could.
Argentinian, the new Argentinian guy did. I was impressed by that.
Oh, is that right? Milieu
Yeah,
flew.
I at
Lufthansa.
least respect that.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah, invite
Well,
got
you
lost in
can't
the
run around with a chainsaw pretending like you're cutting all the red tape and then fly private to Davos, right?
No, you can't. I'll be curious if he really gives them hell or not. We'll see. I feel like everyone kind of conforms there, but I hope to heck he does.
Outside of financials and REITs, what else are you finding that's interesting?
I think energy is interesting. I mean, they took down the strategic petroleum reserve to such low levels, and they've started to put that back a bit. And then you have incredible geopolitical strain. But, the US did produce a record amount last year, and other countries are producing quite a bit too. So I see the bull and the bear argument. For us, it's kind of valuation. I mean, a lot of that stuff I think is pretty attractively valued. And so on dips, especially with our tactical strategies, selling puts to own the stocks at cheaper levels, I think is an attractive avenue there. And some of the dividends on stuff like Devon or Chevron even are pretty attractive. So if you sell puts and then get exercised and parlay that into a covered call or stuff like that, I think there's a lot to be done there.
Tim,
What do
do
you
you feel
think?
like Tim, do you feel like your strategy is good for choppy
Yes.
markets?
Yeah, totally. I was thinking that this reminds me a lot of I'd say like going from 2009 to 2012 a little bit. Just like there's a lot of
Yeah, couldn't find a direction.
And I mean, even stuff like MLPs, if you can get 7% plus a little extra, on I'd be very happy to get double digit returns over the next decade on average. Like I have a tough time believing the indices are going to do that again. I know that's like people are baking into their financial plans, but to me that just seems crazy given where valuations are at. A lot of stuff's priced for perfection, in my opinion.
Yeah, well,
Yeah.
where's it going to come from? Is it revenue? Which that's typically GDP. Is it going to come from profit margin expansion off of already very, very profitable companies? Is it going to come from share count reduction? Kind of already pulled that lever with basically LBOing the S&P 500 over the last decade. Or is it going to come from dividend yield? Or does it come from valuation changes, multiple changes? And you're already
Right.
starting pretty expensive there. So
Right.
tell me which of those five levers can be pulled to produce a 10% annualized over the next decade.
Well, and it's interesting. I mean, the bulls would say AI, will transform, margins for at least the largest. And it's
Even
like, okay,
higher?
I don't know. I mean, you look at NVIDIA, and I mean that one quarter they had, I think it was their second quarter or something like that, was like one of the best quarters I've ever seen. And if you do look, it's interesting because the multiple has come down a lot based on current earnings. But semiconductors has always been a very cyclical industry. So I mean, what does the E look like next year and 2 years from now and 3 years from now? I just don't know. It's in the too hard pile for me, especially with where the valuation is at currently. So not a player in some of those names.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's hard to pick. How do you think about the economic environment? Is that important for energy and for financials? Like if you get a if we really do get soft, how's that?
sensitivity to economic cycles.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I don't think you want to just own the banks outright here. I think it's kind of stock specific. You know, I like a couple of them that are really cheap. Some are in Europe, some are in the US, I think, but they're always going to react. I mean, like you saw March, if there's any hiccup in the economy, you know, they always kind of overreact, which is frustrating. But the reality is they're probably the cheapest sector on a normalized earnings basis. So I think you have to watch that, but I think most people are more constructive on the economy than I might be, or maybe you guys might be. And so if we do see a decent economy and or a soft landing and rates start to go down a little bit, I think that would be a lot, you know, there'd be a lot of deal activity, probably pretty good for growth. So we'll see what happens. But I like the valuations. I think you have a good margin of safety. You've got a big fat dividend on almost all those names. So that gives you a little bit of a cushion. But I'd just be very, you know, valuation focus for sure.
I think it's a tough environment to sort of find your way through because I think a lot of the economic data is ugly, and the 10-3 is still massively inverted. Like I've just stopped talking about it. Mostly, I took a vow of, I don't want to say poverty, but I decided not to
Celibacy.
not celibacy either. But I think I decided not to pay as much attention to the macro. Maybe it's a problem because a podcast is. It's really all we can talk about, but
We'll fix that, sir.
yeah, I think I looked at the economic data was so bad last year, and it just looked to me like imminent destruction. I don't actually think that that much has changed. It's just that I think that the risk is that you get too deter or I get too deterministic. Should try and be a little bit more probabilistic about it. And there's lots of different things that can happen in any given year. Like to what extent do you think that the economy has any impact at all on what happens. Like I would have thought last year should have been a terrible year.
Well, I mean, starting valuations, and one of the good things about you is that you stayed invested, you know, and you had a great year, even if you're, you know, even if
Even if you're
from a,
scared
yeah,
shitless.
even if you, exactly. And I mean, same thing here. I mean, I am not like an optimistic person on a lot of the stuff going on right now, but I'm not invested. I think there's great opportunities in bonds. I mean, a lot of my clients are retirees or people close to retirement. And I tell them, look, I mean, we haven't had interest rates like this in 20 years. So take advantage of that. You finally are being rewarded for being a saver, and you don't need to take all the equity market risk. You know, I mean, take your 7% dividend. I mean, when that banking stuff went down last year, we were buying a lot of investment grade credits at, you know, 8 to 13% yields. Some of those were like a Comerica, you know, so in the spotlight a little bit, but now you look at those and they might be 5 or 6. I mean, it's much, much lower. So they were just no-brainer, double-digit, you know, earning rich investments. And the
And then
only way it went to work is if it would have gotten, you know, hell would have taken over.
you lever that up about 10 times and you should
Then you're LTCM.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they
Yeah.
were like 30 times. You
Oh gosh, I'm sure.
couldn't get enough leverage in them. Maybe it was 100 times or something crazy in
Well,
there.
they were getting like a, you know, 50 bip or, you know, 100 bip type of spread differences and then levering that up 30 times.
I think as the book goes on, they said they were. The they wanted equity like volatility, and so they were trying to do stuff that was riskier to increase the volatility. So in the end, they were doing stuff like VC instead, and
Yeah, you got
wasn't
what you
much of an
wanted.
arb. You get big enough, you just do everything. You do whatever you want.
Yeah. Well, it's like what you learn in economics. I remember in college just learning, oh, you know, the higher the volatility, the higher the expected returns are supposed to be. And yeah, I don't know. It's nothing that drives
Never
me
worked
to,
out that
and
way.
it, I never think about that stuff when I'm actually investing money.
I think Eric Falkenstein has a paper that shows it's the other way around. Lower volatility leads to higher returns, which, I think that should garner him a Nobel Prize in economics at some point.
Yeah, no kidding.
I was
I
going to
would
say, if
agree
it
with
didn't
that.
exist, I'd write it, just so I could get one out there.
I mean, especially yeah, last decade. Sorry, Jake.
That's all right.
Quality's been so good. You know, I mean, quality stocks have done so much better than you know, the more deep value stuff. But maybe that's different over the next decade. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, wasn't that the, I forget who wrote the paper, but wasn't it just Buffett was levered quality,
Oh,
levered
that's
low vol?
AQR.
Yeah.
That's one of AQR's papers. Yeah, he's 1.7 times the quality factor.
Give the man a Nobel.
Yeah.
Yeah, got smart, got lucky, or by design, I'm sure.
Yeah, over 50 years, 60 years, however long he's been doing
Yeah,
it.
he said now what, like they were saying he was like a one sigma event and then two, and now I think they got up all the way to six, which is, one time in the known universe should this ever happen. But now it must be even higher at this point.
Well, I always like the paper, Jake. I'm sure both of you guys are familiar with it, but I believe it was called the Super Investors from Graham to Doddsville, where, he's like, okay, if I was the only one or something like that, but there's so and so, so and so, and he lists all these people that all had similar philosophies but differently done, who had the best long-term track records. And, it's not going to resonate with a lot of people based on, the last 10 years, the way markets have unfolded, but looking at things over 100 years, I think it's as strong, as poignant as ever.
I think you nailed it. I mean, that's there's the world of the last 10 years and everything that worked.
Yeah.
And if you use that as your base rate, then you could construct a very different portfolio than if you look back at the last 100 years and then ask what worked. I mean,
Right.
just night and day differences.
I mean, that's been my experience. I sort of started looking at it in the late 1990s, and I wanted to be a value guy in the late 1990s. And so I remember reading these Fortune articles about value guys who, they had his business, it's got, modestly growing top line, pretty good returns on equity, buying back stock, got a dividend, and it's trading, at a massive discount to all this other stuff that was like the dot-com type stuff that we have today. And then that got increasingly crazy until 2000. So the decade before then was all growth. And so from 2000 to really only probably 2007, maybe it was 2010, it was more value. And then value got really overvalued. And then 2010 to 2020, probably it was growth again. I think it's
Right.
been value since about late 2020, but last year was a little bit anomalous.
Yeah, last year, I mean, value was having the worst year since 2020, except 2020 was the only other one where it was like that, where just value got crushed. But then the last 2 months was just so good for value. I mean, even owning a lot of bonds, still being able to put mid double digits, high double digits type returns from stuff like that was great. So we'll see. One big difference, though, and I think it's you look at like Cisco in 2000, and I don't even know what the PE was. I don't remember, like 145, something crazy like that. And then you look at Microsoft, and if earnings are what they are, what's the 4P, like 28 or 32, somewhere in that range, maybe. It's not 75,
Yeah.
And I mean, if you look at like who's in the best place
Yeah.
business wise, you'd think them as one of them. So it's I don't. It's just hard. It's not for me, it's not for me to invest in that. Like I don't feel a margin of safety in it, but I also don't know that I would say, okay, this is the biggest bubble in that name or a few of those other names ever either.
Yeah, I mean, incredible businesses also. That's the other, I mean, there was at one point, I believe, that the during the dot-com bubble, the most expensive decile had a lower ROE than the cheapest decile. So you had like, sort of better quality businesses actually that were obviously much cheaper, which is a very, very rare occurrence. I mean, you talk about just a perfect setup for a value opportunity set.
I remember talking with you guys about it before, and you're exactly right. I mean, when Microsoft was trading at 12 times free cash flow, I remember Johnson and Johnson trading at, like 13 or 12 times earnings. So yeah, Procter and Gamble was cheap. Like a lot of those
It was
quality
too easy,
names, it
too
was too easy.
obvious.
It was too easy. Yeah.
I gotta get more clever than that if I'm gonna make money, right?
Yeah,
I mean, that was the funny thing about the everybody remembers the 2000s as being a dot-com bubble, but really it was a large company bubble. And it was everything from like Walmart, Microsoft, Cisco, take your pick of all of those really big, high quality, kind of entrenched businesses. They just got too far
Coke.
over their skis.
Yeah,
And it
Coca-Cola,
took,
exactly.
yeah, Coke, another good example, took GE, although GE seems to have deteriorated a fair bit, but GE was like very highly regarded. And they all did pretty well from 2000, 2015, but the stocks just went down every single year. And I remember it was one of the, in 2015, I was looking at Walmart and all those sort of names like they had, you could get leaps on them for just about nothing because there was no volatility in the stock. There was no expectation that they were going to go up, even though the underlying businesses had been compounding at pretty high rates, like 20% a year, something like that. It's kind of amazing. They just get
Yeah.
cheaper and cheaper, but you didn't want to buy a Leap because you didn't know if it was going to go up in 2 years.
Yeah, hadn't gone up in 15, so
Yeah,
why would the
why would it
next
go up in
two?
two?
That's dead money, right?
Right. I know. I was looking at John Deere and you know, a Home Depot I've looked at and Caterpillar. And if you look at just the earnings growth that those companies have seen over the last, let's say, 5 years, it's unbelievable. You know, it's unbelievable. And the stocks, you know, reflect that. They're not like super overvalued if those earnings, you know, can keep growing. It's just it's amazing what they've been able to do.
Well, there was so much CapEx that was put out in the, well, 50 years, I guess, but even let's say like the 10 years before that. And then with Home Depot, for instance, like they slowed down store growth and focused more on driving profitability and then I think retiring shares as well. So EPS just, you had all this CapEx that started just showing up on the bottom line, free cash flow, and then less shares across that. And you just, I mean, just explosion.
True. No, a compounding machine for sure.
JT, it's the top of the hour. You want to do your
I would love to. It'd be my honor.
veggies?
So this is a perfect segue since we were just talking about obvious things to do. And I believe this is the book that Toby was referencing
I
about
think we did
what,
that offline, but
yeah,
yeah.
we did. So the name of this book that we're gonna do a little book report on is called Obvious Atoms. And it was recommended by me to me from my friend Dan Sheehan. So thanks, Dan. And it's a fun little read. Like you can do it in well under an hour. It's super, super quick. But I thought, you know, or you could just listen to this segment if you want instead. But so this was first published as a short story in the Saturday Evening Post in 1916. So it's quite old, more than 100 years old by my math. The story's about this poor young man who wants to get into the advertising business after hearing this spellbinding talk from the president of a famous advertising agency. And the only trouble is this guy, Adams, this kid, is completely unremarkable. He's just average in every way. And to be a successful ad man, you have to be rather clever, right? And so to get into advertising, he makes an appointment with the president. And the president, he you know, talks his way past the secretary, gets in and talks to the president, and the president asks him some questions and determines like there's nothing, this kid isn't bright, like there's nothing, we can't do anything with this. And then Adams, you know, takes that nicely enough when the president tells him this, and he simply says, I've decided that I want to get into the advertising business and that I want to work for you, and I thought the obvious thing to do was to come and tell you so. So don't seem to think you don't seem to think that I could make good on this, so I will set out to find some ways to prove it to you. And I'll call on you again when I have found them. Thank you. Goodbye. And he walks out and just leaves. And the president, you know, is dumbfounded, and he sits, you know, he spends all evening thinking about this kid and their interaction. And he realizes we could use somebody around the office that has sense enough to just do the obvious thing and then like not make it more complicated than it has to be. So the next morning, he sends for this kid and he offers him a job. And Adams comes in, he starts doing this little menial job, and he has some suggestions about obvious improvements to do his job that increased his productivity. And eventually he tells his boss that someone could be doing my job for half of the salary. And so they end up promoting him, and you know, someone else takes that job. And he actually gets into like starting to write copy. And so his ad work was focused on, he just goes and talks to the companies that he's doing the ad work for, and to understand what are they doing? Like what's makes their product special? He gathers the facts, and then he spends a lot of time just thinking about them, and he determines the essential points and then puts them down clearly into ad copy. And that's it. And it worked like a charm. And he became one of the most sought after ad men from just basically discovering the obvious thing to do, hence the name Obvious Adams. So when asked why don't more people do what's obvious, he replies, thinking is the hardest work many people ever have to do, and they don't like to do any more of it than they can help. They look for a royal road through some shortcut in the form of a clever scheme or stunt, which they call the obvious thing to do, but calling it doesn't make it so. They don't gather all the facts and then analyze them before deciding what is the obvious thing. And therefore, they overlook the first and most obvious of all business principles. And then at the end of the book, the author gives you five tests of obviousness in this appendix, which I will share with you now. Number one, and this came from Charles Kettering of GM, who was like a, you know, pretty famous CEO of GM way back in the day in their heyday. And he had it placed on the wall of the GM research building. And this little plaque said, "The problem when solved will be simple." Or said another way, "The solution when found will be obvious." Number two, does it check with human nature? If your idea or plan can't be understood and accepted by your mother, wife, brother, friend, gardener, all these people, et cetera, it's probably not obvious. Human nature makes or breaks any plan, and the public's mind is simple, direct, and unsophisticated. Number three, put it on paper. Write it out like you were explaining it to a child. Can you do this in two or three short paragraphs? If the explanation is long and complicated, it probably isn't obvious. Number four, does it explode in people's minds? If people say, "Now, why didn't I think of that?" Of course,
Too
then
obvious.
then you're probably on the right track. If it doesn't explode in the mind and it requires lengthy explanations and hours of argument, it probably isn't obvious. And number five, is the time ripe? Sometimes the window's passed for an obviously good idea. One is reminded of the quote, "What the wise do in the beginning, fools do in the end." And sometimes the idea is ahead of its time, which then calls for patience and alertness. So I think if you take these five kind of obviousness principles and apply them to your investing, you hopefully can recognize a Microsoft in 2012 at a 10 PE and not try to overcomplicate things and think about, I got to be more clever than that. Anybody could buy Microsoft. And I think, when you look at Buffett's record and the way that he's able to boil things down in, and when he explains it, it's like, oh, well, duh, that's so obvious and a smart thing to do. Oh, the KPI for Coca-Cola is unit cases sold per share. And if I just keep an eye on that, if both of those things are going in the right direction, this is going to work out just fine. I mean, being able to boil it down and become your own obvious atoms, I think is might be one of the like untapped potentials in this entire business. We like to make it so complicated.
Yeah,
I love that.
Jake sent it through to me, and I had to read through it, and I worked out it's 7 words per line, 21 lines in the book, per page. And then I forget the number of pages, but it worked out to about 8,000 words. It's a very quick read. You can like live through half
40
an hour,
40 pages.
40
I mean,
pages.
look how thin this is. This is it. It's a pamphlet practically.
Great book. He tells a great story about being tasked with going and figuring out why a hat store wasn't selling. There were two hat stores and one was selling a lot and one wasn't. And when he tried to find the second hat store, he couldn't find it because it was hidden down an alleyway and you're coming up to a busy intersection trying to figure out why you'd cross over. And he's like, there's the answer. It's too hard to find.
Yeah, and the
Nobody there when you
sign, I
wandered
guess,
down.
was kind of obscured, and no one would have been looking up because they were worried about crossing the street there.
Makes sense. Totally.
Yeah, good little read. I
Yeah.
think that's right. I think that's like the best investment decisions are often in stuff. It's just obvious. And I think Buffett's Apple is also another obvious one in 2016, where it was just over earning. Everybody had an Apple phone. There's a ladder of like you have to keep on buying every few years, or your phone don't work no more.
Yeah,
It's
or the
true.
battery will just start draining mysteriously.
And then yeah, that's right. That's right. You get a whole ecosystem of Apple TV and Apple computers and Apple phones and Apple Watch. You're locked in. No one's getting outside of that ecosystem anytime soon.
Oh, I'm a Android person, so
Me
everyone
too.
hates when I'm on the text messages and stuff. Like,
Oh,
who's the non-Apple?
who's
That's
the
me,
green
this
guy?
idiot. Yeah. No,
Once you
I'm
lock,
that. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
no, you're fine. I was just gonna say once you lock into the Pixel, it's hard to get out of that too. I've got a Pixel.
Oh yeah, that's what I have too. I have the foldable one. I love it.
Oh yeah.
But no, the simplistic explanations for investment makes total sense. That's kind of like my premise on Citigroup. It's look, the stock's at 52, the tangible book value is 86. I think that they could get a 10% ROTCE, and I do know a lot of details, obviously, of the business and the industry. The capital levels are good and stuff like that. So it's a pretty simple thesis. Another one I thought was interested in your guys' opinion on is, what do you guys think, from a fundamental value play? China would be really interesting, but I got burned a little bit on, I own some of that Russian ETF as the war in Ukraine took off, and so that just went to zero. So I'm too scared to touch China. But from a fundamental standpoint, like I think it would be a no-brainer outside of that massive potential issue.
That might be one limitation of that sort of obvious stuff is that in there's two obvious answers there. One is that, yeah, it's all really undervalued and they're all really obviously good businesses too, some of them. So they're going to be much, much bigger in 10, 20 years' time. But then you've got some China regulatory issues there. Might be hard to collect as an outside investor. And whichever one of those turns out to be the pivotal decision, you look back and say, well, that was obvious.
Exactly.
Yeah, but can't you? It's obvious, like,
Option
okay.
size it.
Well, yeah, I was going to say. So, using, let's say that you were of that mind and that persuasion that both of those things were obvious, that there's obvious existential risk and that these are obviously cheap, good companies. So, what then? Yeah, it's a position sizing question then. Like, you put some in there, and but you don't make it too big because it's also obvious that zero is in the cards. And you don't want to necessarily wipe out a huge percentage of your capital with that. But give me 25 similar looking non-correlated versions of that, and I think you end up doing okay.
I thought I was being smart with Russia, and instead of picking like an individual company, I thought, oh, I'll just
Yeah,
own
buy
the
the index.
ETF. I didn't, you don't expect the whole stock index to be valued at zero.
I mean, it was all just gas and banks anyway, so it wasn't like you needed to go special,
True.
hunting through there.
True, true. Yeah. But
Yeah, it was a cheap stock market for a while. I remember Meb Faber has that one of his ETFs has got some exposure to
Givo.
Russia.
Yeah.
Jivo, yeah. I think he looked at like what's I think it works at, it looks at what's a cheap index on a CAPE basis, and then it says what's a cheap what are the cheapest companies in here, and that's how it figures out what it owns. And Russia was cheap. Russia's been cheap for more than a decade now, I think. I guess it's
Very,
like
yeah.
any of those economies, any of those stock markets, and Australia and Canada, I guess, are like this, where it's largely commodity based. And then they've often got big banks as sort of a big part of the index too. They've struggled a lot. Like they struggle in these kind of markets. I don't know what characterizes these markets, but it's been by far and away a sort of US decade, and the rest of the world has suffered, in absolute terms and also in comparison.
100%. Yeah. I mean, Japan had a great year last year, but that's after, decades of underperformance, and Europe has just been a basket case. So we'll see. International is so much cheaper. I definitely own some international stocks, and I'm optimistic that they'll have their r way in the sun, time in the sun.
The US is sort of singular in producing those gigantic consumer discretionary type businesses like Google and Facebook and Microsoft. All that sort of stuff is unique to the US. It doesn't seem to exist. Although China does seem to have its sort of
National champion.
analogous. Yeah. I don't know where it
Yeah.
is. Europe doesn't seem to produce them.
But they have ASML, right, in the Netherlands, that semiconductor company,
Novo
and then,
Nordisk has done just
oh
fine.
gosh, yeah, I know. That'll be interesting to see how that whole trend, plays out for sure. But
Is that the weight
Ozempic.
loss,
Yeah.
all the weight loss stuff?
I mean, that's part of it, but they're also, I mean, they've It's been a pretty well-run company on top of that.
Healthcare's been a good industry
The R,
globally.
like returns on capital when a pharma works, are they're pretty exceptional.
Well, yeah, and those weight loss drugs, I mean, I see it down here. I'm sure you guys do too, but just like I'll go to the gym in Orange County and you see like
They're
the
just giving you
dramatic weight
shots as you
loss.
come in the door.
Yeah,
Just
pretty much. Oh, pretty much. You see the dramatic weight loss, and I mean, I don't know what the long-term impacts are. I wouldn't do it myself, but I can understand the logic and the appeal for people. We'll
Yeah, I
see.
do wonder if Pharma's got a liability there that's matching, a hidden matching, contingent hidden matching liability.
Seems like they find their way out of liability quite a
They
bit
do.
with
Yeah, they
things.
do. They're
Yeah,
quite
they
good at
have a way
that.
of doing
Clever.
that.
I think you just pay enough money to the, you put, send enough, it's not a bribe, what's it called? Lobbying.
Aren't
Yeah.
they the biggest advertisers too? So they're the biggest
Yeah.
advertisers as well.
Oh,
So
yeah.
who's going
They're
to
like
criticize
75%
it on?
of TV re ad revenue or something comes from
That's
pharma.
crazy. Oh yeah.
The other
Yeah.
25% is election advertising.
Kind of makes you sick, doesn't it?
It's going to be a long year. It's going to be a long 2024, I think.
I miss the days when it was, beer commercials with dogs and girls eating hamburgers on the top of cars in their bikinis. Like
There you go.
those were the good old days.
Yeah. Good
Gonna
old
get yourself
Coca-Cola.
canceled. Oh,
Yeah.
sorry. No, yeah, that was exploitive.
I didn't mean to pour cold water. I keep going. I didn't mean to stop. I was
Yeah.
enjoying it. I was
Well,
just making sure that the cancellation was yours alone.
yeah,
Yeah,
thanks. I'll wear that one.
it's tough. I think this market is particularly tough because I see a lot of there's a lot of risk, but I don't think there's a lot of I don't it's not obviously cheap.
When is it
Whereas
easy, Toby? I keep waiting for this. You keep telling me it's tough, but I'm waiting for that time where you say this is easy.
well, I you know I t I tend to like crashes because things get cheap. And then I think you know that you front it. You know, I don't like crashes because they're nerve-wracking to go through, but you get really good prices at the bottom. And that's the time that I feel best. That's the time that I feel most confident.
Did you feel excited in 2020? We'll go back and we got the
Review the
tapes.
tape. Yeah, pull up
Yeah,
the
we got receipts.
I think I remember some of that
I
tape.
was pretty
Yeah, no.
sweaty.
Yeah, it's very sweaty. Yeah, I mean that's why bonds. I think bonds are pretty attractive. You know, I mean, obviously they were more attractive, you know, in October of last year, before the big rally. But if you can get high single digit yield to maturities on good credit quality, like I don't think that's the worst place to be in the world. Plus you have convexity if interest rates decline from here. So I don't think that's the worst, you know, pool to swim in.
Tim, what would you be worried about? I don't know. Let's just say like some geopolitical event, supply chain snarled, we're back to 10% inflation again, and no one was ready for that. Everyone was already cheering that we'd put the inflation genie back in the bottle. That's your downside, right? For
Yeah, I think absolutely. And so the stuff going on in the Middle East, I mean, people should, you know, pay some attention to that for sure. And God knows what else is going to come this year. But yeah, I mean, that would be your biggest downside. But you know, depending on that's why building a bond ladder is important. So there's stuff where you have floating rate bonds, like some really good ETFs that you can use that trade at discounts to net asset value. And then, you know, just build that bond ladder with different durations. And I don't think you have to reach too much in terms of credit risk, but that would be my best answer to it.
yeah, there's some pretty good, like they're relatively cheap now for the rolling over of the bonds that they do for you now in some of these ETFs. Like it's so much better than trying to do it yourself anymore, I kind of feel like.
For a lot of the stuff, yeah, I
If
would
you're trying to
agree.
go buy individual treasuries yourself over and over again, that's real work.
Do you feel that there's an inflation risk in the bonds?
I
Are you
mean, there
just more
definitely is.
tactical? You're not.
That's why it's important to have kind of the bond ladder. You know, I mean, I don't want to be a Silicon Valley bank and buying, you know, 20-year
Yeah.
mortgages or 30-year mortgages, you know, at 1.5%. But also that's where, you know, having some yield and having some floating rate exposure can be really, really helpful here. And I mean, I remember what was 10-year treasuries at in 2000? Wasn't it like 6%,
Oh yeah,
6.5%?
seven. You
And I
were.
just remember, so, you know, in hindsight being 2020, it's like, gosh, man, if we could have gotten 6.5%, you know, on, I mean, that's treasuries, but maybe just take that to the bank, you know, and you miss that whole 80% decline in the NASDAQ. I
Collecting
don't know.
6% from the beach.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's right.
It's a lot of deflationary factors out there too. I mean, you look at used auto or used cars, you know, some of the housing, the way that that stuff's calculated, you know, we'll see. And I still have a tough time believing housing affordability is, I just can't imagine prices aren't going to, I just think they have to go down a little bit. It doesn't make sense. Like the rent to own equation right now does not look very good for home buying.
There's a lot of stimulus out there. The massive, like that Inflation Reduction Act is massively stimulatory. We're running deficits though, like 8 to 10%, which is just massive on a historical basis, particularly when the times and they normally run them are closer to the
Wars.
bottom of a, yeah, when there's a collapse. Like we're running this like at the, I don't know, really know what
The
we're doing at the
best
moment.
economy ever.
You
No,
just. you're right. You're right. That's the whole story of the macroeconomy. Economy is that you have the huge deficits, like a World War II type deficit, and then
Yeah.
you have the reshoring. So manufacturing, you know, in you know, Arizona or you know, Tennessee or whatever, a lot of those cheaper states, Texas, you know, it's just booming. And so it'll be unemployment. I mean, what's gonna cause the Fed to cut? It's got to be unemployment increasing, you know, and if it doesn't increase, then I can't see them cutting. I really
But
can't.
it's still at historically low levels, right? If you
Yeah.
look back. Although almost every single people will make this point that almost every single recession naturally occurs out of a very, very tight labor market, and then it only has one way to go. And when it turns around, it accelerates very, very quickly. That pop sort of seems to happen very quickly, but it's later in the cycle is that,
Hope.
yeah, I'm just forgetting. Michael Cantor has that hope framework, which is housing, whatever it
Something,
is, orders,
something.
profitability, employment, the egos last. It's been kind of amazing to watch, like how long this thing has dragged on, particularly the 10-3 inversion, which historically has been 12 months is the average, and that's October 25, 2022. We're now January, so this would be the longest period of time before seeing any sort of action. We're still like deeply, deeply inverted.
Yeah.
And it's all the front end.
Did all those other inversions have, 8% deficits?
I don't know.
Does that just sort of
This has
like
been a, this is an unusual deficit.
buy time for hope, just
I
extend and
wonder.
pretend? I don't know.
It's what it feels like. It feels like a lot of extend and pretend. And then every jobless number was like revised last year. I mean, there's a lot of stuff, and it's an election year. I mean, there's a lot of factors, like that have to be considered.
Let's get our tinfoil hats on.
I remember 2007 being at my old company, and they'd have the TV on in the background, CNBC, and it was Larry Kudlow. This is a Goldilocks economy. This is
Oh, yeah.
perfect. This is exactly what you want. And then even 2008, that continued until, you started seeing the funds freezing up, and you see those catalysts.
Like
I just want.
January of 2008, like 91% of analysts had. I forget what it was, just like positive expected returns for everything.
Probably the same as this year. I think most people are bullish, at least going into the year before the last couple of weeks. I mean, there was optimism was so darn high.
Yeah.
To be fair, Buffett was pretty bullish in 2007 too.
Was he?
He
He was a big bullish America guy. Like always
Yeah.
bet on America. I always kind of took, I think that he spread that a lot,
He
which,
certainly wasn't bullish on housing. I remember him talking in like the 2006 meeting about like housing is the median income to median price had gotten pretty far out of whack. And he pointed it out.
I think he said something similar last year, didn't he? I recall there being this something similar, a similar exchange last year as well. I remember that one too from 2006. I think that a lot of his earlier stuff was, if you look at, greenbacked emissions and all of that sort of earlier stuff,
Yeah.
I think his tune changed a little bit as he sort of became more of a
Don't you dare
steward.
call him a political animal.
No, I was going to say more of a steward of the system, right? Like he's kind of assumed that role of like, Morgan back in the day where
Yeah.
That's a really good analogy, actually.
they want him to be a calming influence rather than he's not out for himself in Berkshire just telling you what he actually thinks is going to happen. He's trying to get everybody to calm
He's a
down.
shock absorber now.
Yeah. Which is probably why you can discount a little bit of that kind of commentary. A
Yeah,
little bit.
he's not writing how inflation swindled the equity investor today.
Although I think he's pretty blunt about when he discusses it at the meetings. I don't think he sort of gilds it at all at the meetings. It's just when he's on some sort of, when in an interview, he's much more upbeat than he sounds at the meetings.
I
And then
mean,
he'll
yeah.
revert to something like, which is all true, which we would all agree with. Like, and over the very long term, it doesn't really matter anyway. It all works out.
He does a lot of caveating too, like the market
If interest
is
rates don't,
reasonably priced if
if interest,
rates stay this low and
yeah.
returns on equity stay this high, then the market is fairly priced.
Right. And then
Right.
you find his returns on equity the most mean reverting series in finance.
Are they?
Yeah, it seems not, maybe. Maybe not.
I don't know. They were.
It's been amazing. It's been quite an extraordinary period.
Yeah, it really has.
It has, just like the tech bubble was, and they're not the same or anything like that. But yeah, it's always surprising how long stuff can go on. And I mean, it's been weird. You had 2020, which was just such a bizarre year. You had the huge euphoria with like the AMC and all that stuff. You've had a lot. You had like the pseudo banking crisis last year, and now you have the geopolitics and an election year. And we've never had an election like this is going to be after the last one. I mean, it's not, at least in the modern era, it's going to be different. Like, I'm not someone that dwells too much on the macro. I don't let it like dictate my decision making, but I think you can expect a wild ride.
What do you think that let's put the history, we open up the history book in 2050, and what does it say about like the markets of this of today?
That's such a good question. I think it would be, I mean, people thought earnings were going to keep growing, at the same rate. It would be that type of thing where you have high valuations, you don't have mean reversion, which you should expect mean reversion. That's one of the things that Toby does a great job talking about in his books, is that you should expect some type of mean reversion.
That's been wrong.
Yeah,
I was
I
gonna
mean,
say, so
lately,
far.
yeah,
We've
lately.
identified the problems.
Yeah. Maybe it's we'll be idiots for not jumping on China. Who knows? I hope that is the case. I hope that is the case instead of like, well, people didn't jump on it because, that situation got a lot worse.
There's a lot of that in investment where you get right one times in a row. Like if there's we've acknowledged that there's some serious risk with China, but someone could set up a fund, just plow everything into
Oh,
China,
yeah.
have it come true. They're a genius because they've ignored the one risk that everybody else was ignoring, or it doesn't work out in the other way around. They get a big short on or something like that. I mean, I think that's the same thing that Paulson had, that he had that trade on where he was long all of the CFDs or whatever they were, long all of the CDO squared
CDS,
insurance.
yeah.
And it did eventually blow up, but there'd been other people who'd had that trade on for a long time. And
Yeah, went bust before it could pay off.
yeah.
Yeah,
Well, and
there's
there's
so
people
much
that'll
path
have,
dependency on this stuff a lot of times that.
there's people that'll have multiple funds too, and then it's like one of, and this is bigger in some like the see it, the see it managed future space and stuff like that, where they'll have all these different strategies and then they only really market the one that hits a home
Worked.
run,
Yeah.
You run three times long in one and three times short in the other. And the one that works, you change the name to like your flagship fund. And the one that doesn't work, you just memory hole that one.
Speaking of levered long, I saw that there was like a like 1.5 or 2 times NVIDIA ETF. So it's just purely single stock levered long ETF. What a that's kind of reminded of Keynes is what did he say something about when markets become speculative they don't become very good at allocating capital.
Market can remain insane longer than you can remain sane.
Solomon.
Yeah, very true. Well, you know what's big now too are those like covered call ETFs and stuff like that, which gosh, I feel like I missed the boat on that one. Like I wish I would have set
Just
up a damn
watched one of
fund to
those.
do that. Yeah, seriously. I've been preaching that for a long time. But yeah, those are pretty popular now.
Chris Cole did this paper years ago now when Japan, after Japan had no like returns in their stock market for a long time and there was nothing really going on. They started selling a whole of these things called Yuridashi notes. And the function of a Yuridashi note was it basically sold vol. So it sold upside vol and downside vol. And so it's a way of generating yield where there's nothing happening in the markets. But the problem is that the moment that volatility returns, you get knocked out one way or the other really easily.
Yeah.
And so
It
when
was like
vol.
that XIV that
Yeah.
went kaput in like an afternoon.
Yeah. Went like very similar to the Taleb's Turkey. As soon as you see those yield strategies emerge, something's the
About
yield.
ready to kill them. Yeah.
Yeah, the low volatility environment is over.
Oh, you're right. I know we're coming up on time, but I worked at a firm for that was doing that for a long time, and that's kind of like where I learned options. And so they were doing iron condors and stuff like that on the indexes, and this was kind of like prior to 2008, so like 2000 to two or like maybe like 2003 to 2007, there
Yeah,
wasn't a
the
lot of
index is flat.
volatility.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then of course that strategy ended up blowing up. And so I want to make clear to people, when I'm talking about options, I'm only talking about them to generate income and reduce risk. We don't do any speculation on options. So I'm definitely not advocating on that. They're not suitable for everybody.
Hey, Tim,
Yeah.
we are coming up on time.
Yeah.
If folks want to get in touch with you or follow along with what you're doing, what's the best way to do that?
Sure. Our website is www.ptvalueinvesting.com. And then my Twitter handle, I think, is Tim Travis Value, I believe.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, that's always good to have you on. Thanks so much. We'll have you back
Thanks for
again
having
in the
me,
not too
guys.
distant future.
Cool.
And thanks, everybody. We'll be back. Next week, we've got Dan Rasmussen. He's coming on to
Yes. Dan's
set
gonna,
us all straight. Thank God.
yeah, he's gonna give us what everyone's doing wrong.
He's got
He's very good at
Japan
that.
fun too, so he'll.